Access Cast, an Accessibility initiative, presents Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. Hi, I'm Michael Hinkson, Chief Vision Officer for Accessibility and the author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, Thunderdog, the story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust. Thanks for joining me on my podcast as we explore our own blinding fears of inclusion, unacceptance, and our resistance to change. We will discover the idea that no matter the situation or the people we encounter, our own fears and prejudices often are our strongest barriers to moving forward. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is sponsored by Accessibility. That's ACCESSIBE. Visit www.accessibility.com to learn how you can make your website accessible for persons with disabilities and to help make the internet fully inclusive by the year 2025. Glad you dropped by. We're happy to meet you and to have you here with us. Hi there. You are listening to Unstoppable Mindset. Glad you're with us wherever you happen to be. Today, we get to interview or chat with Shilpa Alanchandani. And I got it right, didn't I, Shilpa?
You sure did.
And Shilpa has formed her own company. She's worked with other companies. She's very much involved in the whole concept of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we'll talk about that and chat about that a little bit. But first, Shilpa, welcome to Unstoppable Mindset.
Thank you, Michael. I'm really happy to be here.
Shilpa lives in Silver Spring, Maryland. I've been there before. It gets colder in the winter, a little bit colder than it does here in Victorville in Southern California, but we're up on what's called the high desert. So we get down close to zero a lot of winters. And so we know the cold weather. So we don't get the snow, though, but we cope. Well, thank you for joining us. Why don't you start, if you would, by telling us just a little bit about you growing up or anything like that, things that you think we ought to know about you.
Okay. Well, thanks, Michael. I live in Silver Spring, Maryland now, but this is not where I grew up. I grew up in the Midwest in the suburbs of St. Louis, Missouri. I was actually born in India, but just a few months old when I came here to the U.S. So grew up in a pretty suburban neighborhood in a South Asian family. So kind of navigated between two worlds, my world at home, which was very much a South Asian, eating Indian food and speaking Hindi and, spending time with my family in our small community in St. Louis, and then going to school and being part of a broader world that was really different than mine at home. And I'm the firstborn in my family. So as a firstborn of immigrant parents, you just kind of discovering everything for myself for the first time and not having much of a guidebook to help me along, but just sort of figuring it out as I went. And it was a mostly white neighborhood that I grew up in, St. Louis, which was very segregated at the time, black and white. Not a lot of people who were anything in between, though. So kind of made my way in school. And I actually went to the University of Missouri, Columbia for college. And it wasn't until I finished college that I moved out to the East Coast. And I've stayed here in the DC metro area since, working in lots of different capacities in nonprofit and higher education and government and the private sector, and now as an independent consultant for the past few years.
So where do you fall in the black and white scale?
I'm neither, right? So as someone, as South Asian, did not kind of fit into the dominant white majority culture that I was a part of growing up, and did not fit into Black American culture either, because that's not my heritage. So it was a really interesting space to navigate, to learn in a culture where race and skin color plays a big role in your identity development and the opportunities that you have. It was something that I had to just sort of figure out, where do I fit, and what's my role in what appears to be kind of an unfair system that we're a part of. And then as I discovered how unfair things were, the question became, well, how do I change that? What's my role, being me and my brown skin, to question the systems that are unfair, and to change things to be more equitable for everybody?
Do you think it's unfair all over the world? Do you think it's more or less unfair here, or what?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, every place is unique, and so I don't think, like, necessarily what we experience in the United States is the same as it is in other countries in this hemisphere or anywhere else in the world. And I think there are some global themes around power and identity that really can cut across cultures and countries. Human beings are used to kind of creating hierarchies, and some people having more authority, more power than others. Sometimes that's based on things like skin color. Sometimes, that's based on gender. Sometimes that's based on caste, or that's based on tribe or some other ethnic identity. There are lots of different identities that are used to kind of implement that hierarchical system, but there are some things that are in common across all of them, right? About how people in power retain their power, how people without power learn to kind of accept their circumstances and, kind of not necessarily push back, because when they do, there are consequences to that. And so that it's like a reinforcing system that we get used to and we sort of take for granted. Well, that's just like how the world is. That's how life is. And it takes a lot of courage to question that and say, well, no, well, it doesn't have to be that way. And we can make things more fair for everybody.
Do you think, though, that here we see more of that than elsewhere in the world, or you think it just seems that way because we're here?
It probably seems that way because we're here. I mean,
Yeah.
you're more in touch with what's happening usually in your own environment. And I think for the United States, with as much promise as it has as a country with, ideals around equality and fairness and justice, there's just a really difficult history that we haven't fully grappled with that continues to impact people every day. And so it is a history of, of genocide of Native peoples. It's a history of enslavement of African peoples. It's a history of patriarchy where, women haven't had the same access and rights. It's a history of ableism, a topic, of course, that very well, and this podcast deals with in a really nuanced way, where people who don't fit into the norms of, able-bodied neurotypical folks, are marginalized, and LGBTQ plus folks are also marginalized, and that's not unique to the United States, but it is part of something that's part of our culture that we need to acknowledge in order to change, kind of. Pretending like it's all in the past and we don't really need to worry about that anymore doesn't help us to make things better moving forward.
If there's a difference in the United States, it is that our country was founded on, and we keep touting the fact that all of us are free and all of us are equal, but in reality, it hasn't worked that way thus far.
Right. That's exactly right. And I think that it's often people from marginalized groups who really believe most passionately in that promise, in those ideals, and therefore want to push to make that a reality.
Yeah, and understandably so, because we're the ones who tend not to have truly experienced it.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, what's fascinating to me too, Michael, on this topic of, you know, recognizing the, you know, the inequities and the oppression that exists and what we want to do to change it, is that you would think that if you understand or experience a oppression or marginalization because of one aspect of your identity, that you would then also have empathy across lots of different experiences of marginalization, right? So, for example, as a woman, I've experienced marginalization because of my gender. And so you would hope then that I would be empathetic to, you know, LGBTQ folks, or I would be also empathetic to people with disabilities. And I could translate my experience of marginalization and say, oh, I want to advocate for others who've experienced marginalization. But that is has not necessarily been the case, right? A lot of times we kind of only focus on our own experience, the one that's familiar to us, and have a harder time seeing how there are connections across lots of different identities, and there's power in us actually making those connections instead of, you know, operating in our silos.
Why is that? Why have we not been able to take that leap when we are part of one group, which clearly is marginalized as opposed to other groups who are also marginalized, but we think essentially we're really the only one in town from the standpoint of not translating that?
You know, I think it's we are as human beings much more aware of when we're kind of the outsider and things are harder for us and we've experienced adversity that we need to overcome. But when we're in that insider role, right, in the group that has more power, the dominant group, it's really easy to not pay attention to that, to kind of forget it, to take it for granted, right? So I can say that, you know, as a cisgender person, as a heterosexual person, I have at times in my life kind of taken for granted that I belong to those groups because the world is sort of set up for me. I can date who I want, marry who I want. I don't have to worry about people looking at me, you know, strangely when I'm with my partner. I don't have to think about having photographs of my family, you know, on display. These are not things I have to worry about just because I'm part of those dominant identity groups, right? And when it comes to my experiences of marginalization as a South Asian person, as a Hindu person living in the United States, I'm very like hyper aware of those, right? Because that's where I have felt left out. That's where I have felt like I haven't been treated fairly. And so I think because all of us are like a complex mix of lots of identities, we tend to pay more attention to the ones where we experience marginalization and less attention to the ones where we are part of the dominant group.
But we don't translate that to other groups.
Yeah, because again, we have the capacity to do it, but it takes more effort, right?
And it's all about, though, what we know and what we feel, and we don't tend to take that leap. We're very capable of doing it, but for some reason, we don't recognize or don't want to recognize that we're part of maybe a bigger group of marginalized or unconsidered people. And I think that's probably really it, that we look at ourselves as, well, we are who we are and we make our own way, but we don't have those other people's problems, and so we tend to ignore them.
Sometimes it makes us feel better about ourselves, like, oh, well, you know, at least we don't have to deal with that. And I think when it comes to like race and ethnicity in the US context, there's been a conscious effort to divide people of color from different identity groups. We do have different lived experiences. I don't have the experience of someone being Black, of someone being Latinx, of someone being Indigenous. At the same time, there are some things in common across not being white, right? And the exclusion and some of the disadvantages that come with that, but it's to the advantage of the group that's in power, right? For other marginalized groups to be continuing to sort of fight with one another and not see what they have in common, because then that allows the majority group to maintain their power, right? So you can keep fighting amongst yourselves, right? And arguing about who's more oppressed than whom, but what it does is just allows the people who are in power to keep it. So it really is incumbent upon us to bridge some of those divides, like you were talking about. Like, why can't we extend and see how someone else has experienced marginalization in order to change things? Because that collective action is necessary.
Yeah, and that's really it. It's collective action because somehow we need to recognize that the group in power isn't really jeopardized by other people sharing power or not being so marginalized, but rather it strengthens all of us. And that's what people tend to not perceive. That the whole concept of their power in numbers, there is power in numbers, really is just as applicable across the board. But we don't want to recognize that because we're too focused on the power as opposed to the rest of it. And that becomes pretty unfortunate. And of course, dealing with all those other groups, and then you have people with disabilities, which is a very large minority, second only to women from a standpoint of what we call minorities, although there are more women than men. But then within disabilities, you have different kinds of disabilities that different people have. And that causes, I think, a lot of times another issue because it is more difficult to get all of those groups sometimes to combine together to recognize the power and numbers of everyone working together. And everyone overcoming the prejudices about their disabilities or toward other people and their disabilities.
Yeah, absolutely. And to even consider, the intersections of our identities, right? So there are people with disabilities, many different types of disabilities, like you said. And then there are people with disabilities who are white. There are people with disabilities who are people of color. There are people with disabilities who are, identify as cisgender women or cisgender men or non-binary or trans, right? And so when you kind of look at those combination of identities, it gets even more complex, and it also challenges us, right? It humbles us, I would say, to acknowledge that, wow, I may really be in touch with what the experience of being a person with disability in this country, and but I don't have the experience, for example, of a person of color in this country or a person of color with a disability in this country, and that those are different experiences, and to appreciate those differences, right? We don't need to erase those differences in order to understand each other.
While the experiences are different, what isn't different oftentimes is the fact that we do experience prejudice and discrimination. And we talk so much about diversity that, as I think you've pointed out, we don't talk about the similarities. And we talk about becoming more diverse, and that's great, but that becomes overwhelming at some point. And so, how do we bring it back down to we're all part of the same thing, really?
Well, I think there's kind of a journey that we go on in understanding difference and understanding identity. At first we may not be totally aware of some of the differences around us, and then we might move to a place of feeling polarized around it, that like us them dynamic. Yep, there are differences, but we're better than you, and that kind of a thing. And then we get to a place, and what I'm describing here broadly is the intercultural development continuum, a framework that's used a lot in the DEI space. You can come to a place of minimization, which is really focusing on commonalities, right? We are human, we have common lived experiences, we can focus on common values, and let's minimize the differences, right? But that's really not the end of the journey, because minimizing the differences is at times denying the reality of people's different lived experiences, and it doesn't help us to really change things to make them more fair where they're not. So then we move to kind of accepting the differences, not with value judgment, but just acknowledging them. And then ultimately adapting across those differences, I would take it a step further that not only are we bridging or adapting across the differences, but that we need to learn to be allies, right? So especially if we're in a position of being part of a dominant group, like as I am as an able-bodied person, you know, what does it look like for me to be an ally for people with disabilities? And that's a responsibility that I have, right? So if we minimize differences and we just kind of stay in that place of let's just focus on what we have in common, we don't then have the opportunity to accept, adapt, and ultimately become allies. And that's really the journey that we're on.
What I don't generally hear is not so much about what we have in common or recognizing that we all can be allies, which I absolutely agree with and understand, but we don't get to the point of recognizing the vast number of similarities that we have. And we don't get to the point of recognizing that a lot of the so-called differences are not anything other than what we create ourselves.
We do create differences, and we need to understand those differences in terms of systems, right? Like
right.
entire systems in our society and the way that our, you know, workplaces are set up, and which in the way, you know, physical spaces as well as policies are developed. And those systems are not necessarily designed as fairly as they could be. And so that's when I think paying attention to differences is really important, and not just focusing on similarities, because the same system is impacting people differently, depending on what identity group they belong to. And we've got to be able to surface that in order to change it.
But we do need to recognize that a lot of that comes because of the system, as opposed to whether there are real differences or there are differences that we create.
Yeah, well, I mean, humans create systems, right? And so
they do, right.
We can redesign systems too. But what happens is a little bit like a fish in water kind of scenario, that we don't really recognize the water that we're swimming in.
Right.
And, you know, it really takes us having to leave the environment and look back at it to be able to say like, oh, that's what's going on. Right. Most of the time, we don't pay attention to those systems. We just operate within them without thinking about it.
And that's my point.
Yeah.
And that's exactly it. And so we somehow have to take a step back or a step up, maybe, as you would describe it, to get out of the water and look at the water and see what we can do to make changes that would make it better. And that's the leap that I don't generally see us making as a race yet.
Yeah, there are definitely great examples of that, you know, in our history and in other parts of the world as well. Like when countries that had been colonized for a number of years, you know, finally get their freedom, when, you know, there's real truth and reconciliation efforts after a war or a period of conflict. It is possible. It's something that has happened. And I think, you know, we're kind of in a moment in our culture where people are asking a lot of these kinds of questions. What's not working in the status quo and the way things are, and what needs to shift? The pandemic has really brought those issues front and center. The movement for racial justice has done the same. And I think it's actually an exciting opportunity, an exciting moment to be like, oh, people are actually talking about systems now.
Yeah, it's interesting. Henry Mayer wrote a book called All on Fire, which is a biography of William Lloyd Garrison. Have you ever read that?
I have not.
Okay, so William Lloyd Garrison, you may or may not know, was a very famous abolitionist in, I think, the 1840s. He was a reporter, and he got very much involved in abolishing slavery. And as I said, Henry Mayer was a biographer of his. and wrote this book called All on Fire. And in the book, there is a section where Garrison wanted to bring into the fold some women, the Grimm Kay sisters, who were very much involved in women's suffrage. And he, Garrison, said to his people, please contact them. Let's bring them in. And their response was, but they're not involved in this. They're dealing with women's suffrage and they're not interested in this. And Garrison said something very interesting, which was, it's all the same thing. He took the leap and he said, it's all the same thing, whether it's suffrage, whether it's slavery abolition or whatever, or abolishment, it's all the same thing. And that's the leap that we generally don't take, any of us on any side.
Yeah, I don't know who to credit for this quote that I've heard many times, but the idea that none of us is free until all of us are free.
Yeah.
Right.
An interesting quote and true.
And that's really, I had shared with you, Michael, that my practice is called Mukti. And Mukti means liberation or freedom in Sanskrit. And that was really kind of what was behind, I was thinking about, like, why do I do this work? What motivates me? What is this ultimately about? And to your point of, these experiences, whether it be suffrage or abolishing slavery or whatever, having some really important things in common is that we want to be free. We as humans want to be free. And there are a lot of things that get in our way. And so that kind of became the heart of my practice, is like, what does it look like to work for that freedom?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back to you personally and so on. So you grew up, I think you have, and that's a good thing. And so how did you get involved in all of this division, this business of DEI and what you do today? What got you started down that path? And what did you do that got you to the point of starting this company?
Yeah. So, certainly growing up in the 80s and 90s in St. Louis, there really wasn't a DEI field as such. It wasn't like one of those careers that you know about and prepare for, like being an engineer or a doctor or a teacher or something like that. So it was a kind of a winding, indirect path to get to this place. I knew pretty early on that I cared about justice, that I cared about people understanding each other and bridging differences. But I didn't know that could be my job. So at first I thought maybe I'll become a lawyer and then, I could use like legal skills to fight for justice and things like that. I even took the LSAT and never applied to law school. I was like, I don't really want to be a lawyer. So I explored a bit. I worked in nonprofit and in higher ed and began to learn that, well, there really is kind of a in the late 90s, early 2000s, like a growing field in educating people about diversity. And that was kind of new to me. I was excited about that. I wanted to learn more about it. And early on, it was kind of more focused on representation, right? We need to bring people together from different backgrounds in workplaces and schools, et cetera. And then that sort of evolved into, well, it's not just enough to bring people from different backgrounds together. You need to have an environment where people feel included, where they feel valued, right? So it kind of evolved from not just diversity to diversity and inclusion. And I think kind of the more recent iteration of the field is the E in, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And the equity piece being really looking at that systemic part we were just talking about. How are our systems working for us? Where are there inequities built into those systems? How can those be corrected so that we actually have a place where people from different backgrounds can feel included and valued and feel treated fairly and paid fairly for the work that they do, right? So that's when all of those come together. Of course, there's additions to that as well. Some organizations add accessibility as an A to that. Some include justice. It becomes a bit of an alphabet soup, but all with this idea of differences, valuing differences, and treating people fairly at the heart of this work.
And that's really what it's about. And as you point out, it's really about equity. I've noticed and still very seriously maintain the whole concept of diversity is much less of a really good goal to seek, because traditionally diversity leaves out disabilities. In fact, I interviewed someone a few weeks ago, and this person talked about different kinds of diverse groups and listed a number of things and never once mentioned disabilities. And I asked him about that. I said, I'm not picking on you, but you didn't include disabilities. And he talked about social attitudes. And he says, well, it includes social attitudes in some way. And my point was, no, it doesn't really, because social attitudes are a different animal and don't have anything to do with dealing with disabilities. Disabilities is a different kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how different people approach it. Now, this particular individual was a person who is involved with another minority group, but still we have to face that.
Yeah.
And it makes for a very interesting situation and makes for a challenge in life.
Yeah. I mean, it is one of those places where, you know, I have privilege as someone who doesn't experience disabilities in my life on a daily basis. And that means for me, like, to be an ally, like what we were talking about earlier, is that I need to educate myself, right? I need to look for those opportunities where I feel like, well, yeah, sure, this is easy and accessible for me, but it wouldn't be for our friends and colleagues and people who don't have the same abilities that I do. And what can we do to change that?
Yeah.
Right. That's what the allyship looks like. And I know it can be overwhelming, right? People say, oh, there's so many, you listed so many things under this umbrella of diversity. Like, how can we possibly, you know, pay attention to all of it? And I actually don't think it's too hard for us. I think as human beings, we have this amazing capacity for empathy. We have this capacity to, our minds are malleable. We can continue to learn and grow throughout our lives. We have to have the will to do it, right? And put the effort in to do it, but it is possible.
It's interesting to look at. And one of the things that I think I see, and this is from my perspective as a blind person, or let's say a person with a disability, it's interesting how I think society teaches that all the rest of us are better than persons with disabilities to a great degree. And I think it's very systemic. And I think to a very large degree, it does go across all sorts of different lines, but we teach people that, I teach our children, that disabilities make those people less in ways that it doesn't necessarily apply to other groups. Although the concept and the overall process is the same, it still comes down to we're in power, we're better than they, but it does go across a lot of different lines. And when we teach people that disabilities are less, that's a problem that somehow we, as part of all this, need to overcome.
Yeah. And, you know, it's ultimately, Michael, to your point, it's dehumanizing, mm-hmm. right? We're dehumanizing entire groups of people. And sometimes it's like, quote unquote, well-intentioned, but it's really more of a pity than it is an understanding, a respect, and empathy for someone else's experience. And nobody needs that, right?
No.
Nobody wants to be felt sorry for, you know?
Yeah. And I think that probably is more true when you're dealing with a person with a disability than a lot of other groups. You won't feel sorry for them. You may distrust them or whatever, but for disabilities, we feel sorry.
Yeah.
And that promotes fear. Gosh, we sure wouldn't want to be like them.
Right. Because that's the worst thing that could happen, right? So
right.
Then it creates more of that division of, I'm not like you and I don't want to be like you, you know?
Right. Right. On the other hand, disabilities is an equal opportunity kind of a thing. Anyone can join us at any given time unexpectedly or maybe expectedly, but to use a bad word, expectedly. I don't know. That's not a word. But anyway, so we have to learn to speak. But still, it is something that anyone can experience. And we don't try to equalize. So it is a challenge. But again, let's look at you. What was your career like getting into this? So it wasn't a job that really existed as such. And then you kind of discovered that maybe it really was. And so you decided not to be a lawyer, and we won't talk about the legitimacy or efficacy of not being a lawyer, although there's so many lawyer jokes out there. But what did you then do?
Yeah. So, my early work was at a nonprofit that no longer exists, but it was the National Multicultural Institute, and they were kind of doing diversity training for organizations and like the World Bank and educational institutions and some nonprofits. And then I discovered like, oh, this is becoming a growing thing that businesses, organizations want education around issues of diversity and how they can work better together across difference. So that was really fascinating to me. I also got involved in cross-cultural communication. So when I was teaching at American University, it was in the School of International Service, which had as a requirement for any international studies major to take a course on cross-cultural communication, to recognize that, you know, depending on what culture or part of the world we're from, we really kind of think differently, communicate differently. And it doesn't mean that that thinking or that communication is good or bad, but it's different. And we really need to appreciate, you know, how some cultures are much more direct and some are much less so, right? Very indirect. How some cultures engage in conflict really, you know, emotionally, and others are much more emotionally restrained, you know, and some are much more individualistic, and others being more collectivist. So I started really studying these issues and realizing that there really was an opportunity to educate people about some of these cultural differences and identity differences and ultimately power differences that exist in our societies. So I worked internationally. I worked at the Peace Corps, and I've traveled with the Peace Corps to different countries to train staff who worked for the U.S. Peace Corps. I worked for the State Department, and I did leadership development work there to prepare foreign service officers before they go abroad and during their service on how to lead effectively in those global environments. And then I decided to leave government after a while and pursue private sector. And there's a lot, like in the private sector, wow, there are a lot of organizations that invest heavily in diversity, equity, and inclusion, big training programs, a real focus on how to make their policies and procedures more equitable. So that was really interesting, you know, to get into that consulting space, first working for a firm called Cook Ross. And then 3 years ago, I went out on my own and started my own practice. And I love the work. It's challenging. You know, there's some people who are in it for the right reasons and others maybe not as much. So I'm learning a lot in this field now, 20 plus years into it, but also feeling quite fulfilled in the work that I do.
So what does Cook Ross do, or what did they do?
They're a diversity, equity, and inclusion consulting firm that they work a lot with the Fortune 500, even Fortune 100 corporate sector. In my independent consulting practice, I'm doing less kind of corporate work and more work in the NGO sector with smaller businesses, nonprofit organizations, and the like.
What made you decide to go out on your own?
I had thought about starting my own business many times. And really erred on the side of stability and a stable paycheck for so many years until finally I had some supports in place, right? Talking about systems, I had some supports in place to make it possible for me to go out on my own. I had a partner who had a steady job with health insurance for us and for our two children. My parents moved closer to where we live, so I had some family support in the area. And then, decided just to take the leap and have confidence in myself and what I could offer as a consultant, as a facilitator, to clients. And the vast majority of my work is through word of mouth. I really don't even do, much marketing, and I'm very fortunate, to be in that role, but it also just showed me like, huh, you might have, maybe you could have done this sooner, but it took me a while to feel like I had the support and the confidence to do that.
But even though you're on your own, do you still have a relationship or do any work with Cook Ross, or do you still teach or
I
any of
work
those
with some
things?
other consulting firms, small consulting firms, so I subcontract for them, and it, this, I, in addition to my consulting practice, I became a certified coach. I went through a coaching program and became an International Coaching Federation certified coach. So I work one-on-one with people, largely women of color leaders who are, in periods of transition or growth in their lives and in their careers to help guide them through that process and help them really tap into all of the strength that they have and the wisdom that they have within themselves. So I have a lot of variety in the work that I do, which I really enjoy.
So you keep connections open, and that's always a good thing, of course.
Indeed.
So what kind of changes have you seen in the whole field of diversity, equity, inclusion, and such over the years?
There have been a lot of changes. I think, I mentioned early on there was a lot of focus on representation. I think a big, and then, looking at the culture and how can we be more inclusive. But even in that conversation about inclusive, Michael, there was a bit of how teaching people to be like us, right? Like, so there was still sort of a dominant majority white male, able-bodied, cisgender, heterosexual, culture. And we invite people who belong to other groups, marginalized identities, to join us, but to kind of be like us, right? And then I saw a shift. Well, no, the point is not to make everybody act like the majority group. The point is to actually create a place where people with different experiences, different identities can all thrive in the same environment. That means changing the environment, right? That means actually looking at some of those systems, looking at the culture, and saying, if it's a culture of like everybody goes out for happy hour after work, or they have important conversations on the golf course, or whatever, that is really fundamentally excluding a lot of people from those informal ways that people hold power in the organization. So, how do we create cultures and systems that are more fair for everyone? I think now, especially post the murder of George Floyd in 2020 and a real reckoning with the history of racism in the United States, there's much more attention being paid to some of those systemic issues in with particular regard to race, but also other identity groups. And that's a big shift. There were a number of years when I worked in this space where people were still like uncomfortable naming race. They would talk about diversity broadly, talk about all the different things that make us the rainbow of people that we are, but not deal with some of the harder, stickier, messier subjects. And I think there's more of a willingness to do that now. And
They won't deal with the words. Yeah, go ahead.
yeah. There's more. So there's like a caveat to that. There's also a lot of people who say they want to do that more difficult and challenging work, but when confronted with it, actually retreat and say, "Oh no. I'm not comfortable doing this. This is a bit too challenging, too threatening. It's making me really uncomfortable." And so there are organizations, there are leaders who have said one thing, right, and publicly made announcements about how they're anti-racist or they're, all about equity or whatever, but then that hasn't necessarily followed through in the action. So that's something that's we're dealing with now in the field. In some places, there's a openness, a recognition for some of those difficult topics. In other places, it's really just on the surface. As soon as you go a little bit beneath the surface, you realize that the commitment is really not there.
Now you have me curious. So you've got the company or the group that does go out on the golf course and make decisions, or that goes out for lunch and has martinis and make decisions. And there are reasons for it. The reasons being that you're going away from the company, you're going away from the environment, and you can think and you can have all sorts of rationales or reasons for doing it, but nevertheless, it happens. How do we change that? How do we address that issue? Do we, when we have people who are excluding because they don't go out on the golf course, do we create an environment for them to be able to go on the golf course, or do we do something different, or are we there yet?
I think we're there. I think that, first of all, we need to recognize that some of those informal practices are in fact unfair. And then if you're wanting to let go of them and say, well, what we liked about that was that it was somewhat informal, right? But are those the only informal spaces you can create, right? Not necessarily. There are other ways that people can connect informally in an organizational context that aren't around, you know, alcohol, or aren't around a particular sport, or aren't around a particular, you know, activity that necessarily excludes, or that are always after hours. So this is something that women have really struggled with, is that, you know, if those important conversations, side conversations, are happening not during work hours, and there still to this day, women have more responsibilities at home with family than men do, then that's an automatic disadvantage. Like you're not even in the room. You're not even there to be part of those exchanges. That doesn't just apply to women, but that's just that's an example. So how do we then think about leadership differently? How we develop people, what our decision-making processes are, how we hold each other accountable for those decisions. It kind of comes down to your organizational values and how you live those values in the way in which you lead and the way in which you engage in your work and your interactions with your colleagues. It's easy to say on paper, much harder to practice those values.
Why is that?
Oh, well, you know, everybody likes to have on their website or on the wall in the conference room, oh, we believe in integrity. We believe in inclusion, right? We believe in collaboration, or whatever the values may be. But what does that actually mean? What does that look like? How do you, Michael, and how do I, Shilpa, behave in accordance with those values, right? That's a bigger question.
It gets back to talk is cheap.
Absolutely. Talk is really cheap. It's easy to make these pronouncements and to say the right thing. It's much harder to practice them. And so when I engage with clients, it's really looking at those organizations and those individuals that are interested in making some change. They're like, okay, we know this is not going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen because you did one workshop with us and then we all went home. It's going to happen over time by articulating the behaviors we want to practice, building the skills to practice those behaviors, building the accountability for us to actually implement those behaviors and those changes in our policies. Then we could actually create some long-term change. That's not easy. It's not sexy. It's hard work. And that's how you create a more diverse, equitable, and inclusive organization.
And it is very uncomfortable. And it's what really causes a lot of the hatred. So why is it that people hate race differences so much? Because they're different than us. They're not as good as we are. And although in reality, they can demonstrate that they are as equal as we are, whoever we are, the fact is that they're calling us on it. We don't like that. We don't like change. And the reality is we need to learn to change.
Yeah. And this whole idea, you know, we all think of ourselves as good people, right? So when someone points out some way in which I have been exclusionary or discriminatory in my behavior, my first instinct is to defend myself, but I'm a good person. I would never try and hurt another or discriminate or exclude. But in fact, as a human being that operates in these systems that we are a part of, I have at times excluded. I have at times been unfair in the way I've treated people and just and been discriminatory. And so it's important for me to be able to acknowledge that I can be a good person, but part of being human is that I do have some of these challenges. Then only can I change it and work to change some of the systems. If we're going to live in denial, like, nope, we're good people, and therefore we can't hear any of this criticism, it's not possible for me to be unfair, unjust, or discriminatory, then how are we ever going to change?
Right, which is of course the whole point, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's hard. It's a tough. I always come back to humility in this work. If you are to engage in a sincere way to build a more equitable and inclusive world for everyone across identity groups, you will be humbled time and time
It's
again.
hard because we haven't learned to do it. And also, many of us just really ultimately don't have the desire to learn to do it, and that's what we have to change. What are some of the major mistakes that you've seen organizations make? I think you've referred to some of this already, but it's worth exploring a little more.
One thing that we haven't talked about yet, but I often hear from clients who seek out my services is that, oh, we really need to focus on recruitment, right? We just need to get a more diverse leadership team. We need to do a better job of reaching out to, XYZ group that's underrepresented in our organization. And they put a lot of effort into recruitment. And then what happens? You bring in people from all these different backgrounds that you said weren't represented, and now they're there, but there hasn't been much emphasis on inclusion or equity. And you've created a revolving door because very soon, people from those marginalized identity groups discover this isn't a place where they really feel like they're valued, or it's not a place that's set up to really support them to be successful, and they leave. And then those same organizations are like, but we put all this money and time and effort into diversifying. What did we do wrong? So to that, what I say time and time again is we have to start with equity and inclusion, and then the diversity will come. You don't start with diversity and with recruitment, and then just with wishful thinking, hope that it all works out once everybody's together in that organization. Quite often it doesn't.
It ultimately comes down to changing the mindset, which is really what doesn't happen. And diversity doesn't change the mindset. And I
Oh.
think that's something that conceptually inclusion can really help to do, is to change the mindset. If you're really going to look at what inclusion means, and that's why I've always loved to talk about, and I have a speech called Moving from Diversity to Inclusion, because people clearly have already changed diversity to the point where it doesn't necessarily represent everyone. But ultimately, all those people, I think, still try to do it. You can't say you're inclusive unless you are. You can talk about being partially inclusive, but that doesn't mean a thing. Either you're inclusive or you're not. And that means changing a mindset.
It does mean changing a mindset, and that mindset allows you to change some of your practices. Like it can be as simple as like, how do you design an agenda for a meeting and how do you facilitate that meeting? And how do you actually include all of the voices of the people who are part of that group? A lot of just you think about how many times people in organizations, how much time people spend in meetings, and a lot of them are not particularly inclusive. Like half the people are checked out. There are a few people who dominate the conversation, right? And it seems it's such a waste, right? It is such a waste because there are ideas that are not getting shared. There are conversations that are not being had. There are conflicts that are not getting resolved, right? Because we're just used to doing things in the same way. If we
Right.
can change that mindset, like you said, and also some of the practices, even small things like that will make a difference, right? People will start speaking up in a different way.
Right.
And the whole dialogue shifts.
And that's what we really need to work toward, is that dialogue shift, that mindset change, and that makes a big difference in all that we're doing. Tell me a little bit more about your company, about Mukti, and what it does and how people can learn about it.
Great. So yeah, Mookti, M-O-O-K-T-I Consulting is my organization. As I mentioned earlier, Mookti means liberation. And I have two parts to my practice. One is organizational training and consulting. So I provide and facilitate workshops and leadership development series for organizations on all kinds of DEI related topics. Interrupting bias to feedback on microaggressions to, leading with an equity lens and using a systems lens to solve problems in your organization. And I really enjoy that work, that organizational training and consulting work. The other part of my practice is coaching, and that is one-on-one with individuals. Primarily, I focus on women of color leaders because coaching remains a white dominant profession in the U.S. And there's a real opportunity for people of color to enter this field and a lot of clientele who are looking for coaches who understand not just their leadership journey, but also how their identities impact them every day. So being a woman and a woman of color in a leadership role in an organization is different than being a man or being a white man in particular. And so those one-on-one coaching conversations that I have with my clients really can unlock their potential, can free them up to make decisions that are more aligned with their values and make choices in their career that are more fulfilling for them. So in all aspects of my work, I'm about, freeing people from the systems of oppression that limit us. Some of that work is organizational and some of it is individual.
If people want to reach out and contact you and explore working with you and so on, how do they do that?
Sure. So my website is the best way to learn more about me and my work and also to contact me. And the website is simply mukticonsulting.com.
Have you written any books or are there other places where people can get resources that you've been involved in creating?
Yes. I mean, I did write a book a number of years ago, Communicating Development Across Cultures, which is more focused on cross-cultural communication in the international development field. So not as much on organizational DEI work as I'm doing now. I'm quite active on LinkedIn and do post my own articles on LinkedIn. So that's a good place to find me as well.
How can people find you? Can you, I assume by your name, can you spell all that for us?
Yes, if you put Shilpa Alamchandani in LinkedIn, I'm the only one. So you'll find me pretty easily there.
Why don't you spell that if you would, please?
Sure. So Shilpa is S-H-I-L-P as in Peter, A. And Alamchandani is A-L-I-M as in Mary, C-H-A-N as in Nancy, D as in David, A-N as in Nancy, I. So it's a long one, but a phonetic name. In fact, on my website, I have a little button where you can click pronounce and it tells you how to pronounce, with an audio clip of how you say the word Mookti and also how you say my name, Shilpa Alamchandani.
Well, I hope people will reach out because I think you're talking about a lot of very valuable things. And I think we really need to look at inclusion and really create a new mindset. As I said, I have a speech called Moving from Diversity to Inclusion. In fact, it's the second episode on our podcast. So if you haven't watched, I hope you'll go see it.
I will.
There's my plug. And then my fourth episode is a speech that Dr. Jacobus Tembrick gave. Dr. Tembrick was the founder of the National Federation of the Blind and one of the foremost constitutional law scholars. And the speech he gave at the 1956 convention of the National Federation of the Blind is called Within the Grace of God. And especially the last two paragraphs of that speech, I love. But it's a great speech that I think, whether you're talking about blindness or any other kind of group, it applies. He was definitely a visionary in the field and was a great thinker about it. So that again, that's episode 4. I hope that you and other people, if you haven't listened to it, will all go out and listen to
it. You know, Michael, I did listen to that upon your recommendation, that episode 4, and that speech was really moving and inspiring. And what I would say more than anything else, I felt that it was empowering. It was so empowering. And thank you for recommending that.
And he thought that he was being gentle with people in talking about discriminations and so on. I mean, in later years, he delivered another speech in 1967 called "Are We Up to the Challenge?" And he thought that he was much more forceful in that. He started the speech by saying, and again, it's about blind people, but it goes across the board. He said, blind people have the right to live in the world, which is interesting. But I still think his 1956 speech was his best. And I think there are others who agree with that.
Well, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you, Michael. Thank you so much for inviting me onto the podcast.
Well, I am glad that you came, and I hope that you will come back again. And definitely anytime you have more insights or whatever, or if there is any way that we can be a resource for you, and I'm sure others will feel the same way, please let us know. But Shilpa, I really appreciate you coming on, and all of you, I appreciate you listening today. So we hope that you'll give us a 5-star rating and that you will reach out. Let me know what you think of what we had to discuss. I'd love your thoughts. All of the information will be in our show notes, including how to spell Shilpa's name. And we hope that you will let us know your thoughts. So once more, Shilpa, thank you for listening. You listen too. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you all. And we'll see you next time on Unstoppable Mindset.
You have been listening to the Unstoppable Mindset podcast. Thanks for dropping by. I hope that you'll join us again next week and in future weeks for upcoming episodes. To subscribe to our podcast and to learn about upcoming episodes, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. Michael Hingson is spelled MichaelHingson. While you're on the site, please use the form there to recommend people who we ought to interview in upcoming editions of the show. And also, we ask you and urge you to invite your friends to join us in the future. If you know of anyone or any organization needing a speaker for an event, please email me at speaker@michaelhingson.com. I appreciate it very much. To learn more about the concept of blinded by fear, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/blinded by fear. And while you're there, feel free to pick up a copy of my free ebook entitled Blinded by Fear. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is provided by AccessCast, an initiative of Accessibe, and is sponsored by Accessibe. Please visit www.accessibe.com. Accessibe is spelled AccessIbe. There you can learn all about how you can make your website inclusive for all persons with disabilities and how you can help make the internet fully inclusive by 2025. Thanks again for listening. Please come back and visit us again next week.